Call this meeting, the Judiciary Committee, to order. Members, take your seats. A quorum is present. Today, we're going to be hearing three bills. House File 3075, four bills. House File 3075, Elkin, 1424, Stevenson, 3715, Lesh. Oh, two bills from Lesh. Okay.
Are you surprised?
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing until I read the agenda when I sit down here. So, but we still have the minutes from March 4th.
So moved.
They've been moved by Chair Considine. Any discussion about the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor say aye. Aye. All opposed say no. Motion passes. The minutes are approved from March 4th. And our first bill up is House File 3075, Representative Elkins, classifying as private certain data on users of a shared mobility program. I'll move that House File 3075 be recommended to be placed in the General Register. Representative Elkins, no amendments, right?
No amendments. No.
Okay, please tell us about your bill.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have with me Matt Ayling from the Minnesota Council on Government Information. Matt actually did most of the heavy lifting on the drafting of the bill. It's kind of modeled after a similar provision that that renders personal information collected by transit providers to be private and non-public. And this extends the same treatment to any data which local, state, or local governments collect related to shared mobility services. So the catalyst for the bill is that the city of Minneapolis has begun to collect data from the scooter companies. And to their credit, they're not actually, they're, as they take in the data, and it's a format that is a national standard originally developed by the city of Los Angeles, the raw data is very granular and has personal information in it. To their credit, they're stripping that data out before they actually write it to disk. But given that that national standard for that data does include personal information and includes very detailed trip origin and destination data, concern is that other cities who might take this data for local planning purposes might not necessarily do that, and so it's important to protect the privacy of the data being collected from companies of companies that are providing these services.
I'm sorry, Representative Elkins, please excuse the noise over there. It's just that really loud.
I know.
I'll just go on.
That's not noise.
I was blinded when he walked in, but. But so anyway, so this is in some sense precautionary, but it's written broadly enough to cover any form of shared mobility, even though the data being taken from by Minneapolis right now is just scooter company data.
Excellent. Thank you. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Ayling. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Matt Ealing, Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. We'd like to thank Representative Elkins for reaching out to us to have a collaborative discussion on how to best frame this this bill. Most of you know, our organization is primarily focused on government data transparency. When issues come up, there are public policy issues that involve the classification of private data. We would certainly welcome members to have conversations with us. Our aim is to try to find language that specifically addresses that kind of private data classification as possible, as this bill does, so as to not have collateral impacts on otherwise public information that could be useful to the general public. So, for instance, this bill is very targeted at individual level identifiable data shared by companies with government entities, but it leaves public information about how those entities interact with the public sector, so things like contracts and other information that show that interrelationship are not affected. So we feel that this is a good template for moving forward on how to address issues involving private data.
Thank you. Are there other testifiers that you have, Representative Elkins? Okay. Is there any from the audience who wishes to be heard on this bill, House File 3075? Anyone out there? Public audience, no one. Okay, we'll go to member questions. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs. I switched chairs here. Make a room for Representative Barr. I'm on the bill, and I do have a couple of questions. The first one is how long is this data being kept, and why would it be kept for more than a few months, or really be kept at all long term? And that question, Mr. Chair, would be to the bill author.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The reason why cities and, or counties or regional governments or the state would keep this, but particularly cities, is that they will need it for contract enforcement and for planning purposes. So in this case, the case that catalyzed the bill, the city of Minneapolis is taking data from the scooter companies really for two basic reasons. One is that the contract requires the scooter companies to distribute their scooters out equitably across the city instead of only concentrating them in high demand or wealthy areas. The second reason is that the city needs to know, for example, where are these things accumulating, because they are looking to see, should we start providing dedicated scooter parking in particular areas where there are high concentrations of these to keep them off the sidewalks, for example. So the city is already the subject of a lawsuit from the disability community over the issue of people just leaving them out on the sidewalks and impeding access to persons using wheelchairs, for example. So those are good examples of the kinds of reasons why a local government might want to collect this data and have a history of it so that they can analyze patterns of usage by time of day or day of week.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question, and I understand that.
Yeah.
I get that. Mm-hmm. My question is, why would they need to keep this personally identifying information, including, you know, you use a credit card or whatever to use a scooter, and why would they need to keep that financial information and those sorts of things for any period of time, or are they doing that now?
No, they're not doing that now, Mr. Chair. To the Minneapolis's credit, they're handling the data just the way I would want the data handled as an IT data professional. So they are stripping out themselves all of the personally identifiable information, all of the detailed trip origin and destinations. They're as they process the data, as they take it in, they're rolling it up to the midpoint of a block, the center line of the street, so that the address information is obscured and a big group of addresses are grouped together. Because for planning purposes, they don't need to really see it below that level. My concern came when I studied the format of the raw data and realized that all of this additional information was there, and a concern that other units of government taking this data might not go to the trouble that the city of Minneapolis is going to physically strip that data out, because the path of least resistance from an IT perspective would just be to import the data in the format in which it's provided.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And one final question, and that is the city stripping that personally identifying information before they send it to the scooter company with whom they have the contract?
No, they're receiving the data, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. They're receiving the data from the scooter companies and stripping out the personal information and then storing it on their computer for analysis. So they're not sending data to the scooter companies. The scooter companies are sending the data to them.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Excellent. Okay, any other comments from the committee, discussion? Seeing none, then the motion's been made. The House Representative Elkins, do you want to take another chance to sink the bill? Looks like you got the votes.
No, I think I got the votes on this one. I just I'll point out that we did involve a diverse group of stakeholders. So the League of Minnesota Cities was involved, MNCOGI was involved, the Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota, the Met Council were all involved in vetting this bill.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. The motion is House File 3075 be recommended to be placed in the general register. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The bill is passed and moved to the general register.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Ealing and Representative Elkins. And House File 1424, Representative Stevenson establishing a student loan advocate, requiring a licensure of student loan servicers, prohibiting certain practices of student loan servicing. I'll move that House File 1424 be recommended to be referred to State Government Finance. And you have an A-10 amendment, is that right, Representative Stevenson?
Mr. Chair, yes, I do.
Okay. Can I have a motion to put the bill in the form the author wants?
Motion.
Okay. What's your name again? Representative Cantrell. Move the A-10 amendment. And any discussion on the A-10 amendment?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Chair Scott.
Thank you. This actually, I probably have more questions on this A-10 than I do the rest
okay.
of the bill.
Okay, let's do them.
So thank you for recognizing me. Part of my concerns with this is the data sharing and the class, maybe not so much the classification of the data, but the data sharing. And I had a few questions around surrounding that. And I'm just wondering, for the first question, is why local, state, or federal law enforcement agencies would need any of this data?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I think that in the eventuality that serious fraud was discovered, it might be appropriate for the Attorney General's Office or the Department of Commerce staff to report that to law enforcement.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, if there's serious fraud, wouldn't that be the Attorney General's office that would be taking the action on that, not necessarily law enforcement?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, it might be, it might not be, depending upon the jurisdiction of what happened and the offense and the jurisdiction of the Attorney General's office.
Mm-hmm. Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And let me come up with my other question. I've had a lot of things going on this morning. But
sure. Are there, Chair Liebling, do you have a question?
Well, Mr. Chair, I just would like to get a presentation of the bill. I mean, I understand that Chair Scott has some concerns, but that's the amendment. I mean, we haven't really heard what the bill is about yet. I just wanted to get some of that background.
While Chair Scott is prepping another question, why don't we just go ahead and go through that then? You can explain the bill as you would with the A-10 amendment adopted, maybe explain if there are differences there. Go ahead, Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The student loan debt crisis that is sweeping the country, I think, is probably well known to most members, and I won't belabor the point as I know you have a busy agenda, but just to give you a few facts and figures, in the United States right now, there is over $1.5 trillion in student loan debt. That statistic is actually a little bit dated now, so it's probably significantly higher. That is a higher amount of student loan debt than credit card debt. In fact, student loan debt is the second largest source of debt in the United States, behind only mortgage debt. Here in Minnesota, again, these are a little bit older. These statistics are from last year, but we have over 775,000 student loan borrowers carrying over $27 billion in student loan debt. Between the years of 2007 and 2017, there was a 127% increase in student loan debt in Minnesota. And this is not a metro problem. It's not a suburban problem, urban problem. It's a Minnesota problem. In fact, 51% of millennials living in rural Minnesota carry significant student loan debt. And the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis has done some research indicating that student loan debt is a very significant reason why young people leave rural communities, because the cost of carrying that debt is prohibitive in those communities. And so this is a bill that has great concern for the entire state of Minnesota. Mr. Chair, what this bill does is essentially two things. I would first say that the first piece you can kind of think of as a borrower's bill of rights. What we're asking is that certain protections be encoded in state law to make sure that the service student loan servicing companies that manage this debt are treating our Minnesota borrowers fairly and above board. You know, let's make sure the payments are applied to the direct loans, that they're getting the information that they need to have their loans processed fairly. There's a confusing web of student loan programs out there, and it leads to some really disastrous outcomes that I certainly could speak in more detail about if necessary. But it's important to have some basic rules of the road for how our student loan servicing companies are going to operate. The second piece of the bill puts a cop on the beat. It creates a student loan advocate, puts it in the Attorney General's office. This is a change in the bill. Last year it was in the Department of Commerce. In the interim, we had some discussions and found that we'd be better situated in the Attorney General's office. So we're going to move it there. That's why we're going to StateGov Finance next to have that discussion. But those are the basic elements of the bill. And I don't know, Mr. Chair, if you want to do more discussion at this point. There are testifiers who wanted to testify as to the bill.
Okay. Chair Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, on the amendment. And there's a... there's an awful lot of data sharing going on here between the United States Department of Education, the Office of Higher Education, Department of Commerce, Office of Attorney General, and state and local and federal law enforcement agencies. That's a lot of data sharing. And this in my opinion, I know there's something in the bill that says that they have to get the consent of the borrower, but I believe it ought to be very plain language in some sort of a Tennyson warning that says, you know, any assistance provided by this office means that your data can be shared with the United States Department of Education, the Office of Higher Education, and list those things out in the Tennyson warning so that people are fully aware of where their information may be shared. And I would also think that this bill should delineate what kind of data sets are going to be shared. Is it just their name, address, loan number, et cetera? I think the borrower also needs to know what kind of their data will be shared, and that needs to be explicitly outlined in a bill like this. And then if you know how long this liaison's office is going to be keeping the data, do you know the answer to that, Representative Christensen, or have an idea about how long they might need to keep that information? Stevenson, I'm sorry.
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, I think that the length of data retention would be covered by the data policies and procedures that those two agencies, the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Commerce, have. The A-10 amendment makes the data maintenance in the Attorney General's Office governed by Section 13.65 and the Commerce Department under Section 46.07. I think, you know, when you ask about how long they would keep it, probably is going to depend upon the specific case and how that interplays with the those agencies' existing rules and practices about keeping investigatory data.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And do you know what data sets are going to be shared amongst, or potentially shared amongst, all these agencies?
Representative Stevenson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Scott, again, I think that the when you're talking about what would be shared, it probably is going to depend a little bit upon the instance of the borrower and the aid who you're sharing with. So as I already articulated, some of the data might be shared for the purposes of a law enforcement investigation. That would probably go beyond name and account number. But in other cases, it might be so basic. I thought your comments about making sure that students adequately understand before they engage in the process with the student advocate what their data might happen has some merit, and I would commit to working with you on that in the days to come. As I mentioned, the committee this bill has a couple more committee stops to make.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thanks, Chair Scott. Okay, so the A-10 has been moved by, who moved it? Representative Cantrell moved the A-10. All in favor of the A-10 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. The A-10 is adopted. And Representative Noor, you've got a friendly amendment, right?
Yes, Mr.
The A-11. Does everyone have the A-11?
Mr. Chair, I move A-11 amendment.
Okay, and it exempts the University of Minnesota because they have their own loan servicers.
Correct, so they're exempt because they're not considered as a loan servicer, yes.
Okay. Well, any discussion on the A-11? Chair Scott.
So they're not a loan servicer right now, but I guess, could they potentially become a loan servicer? Is there somebody here from the U that can explain this?
By the way, I just paid like $4,000 yesterday to the U. How much of that do you get? I'm just kidding. And I don't get any loans either. So go ahead, our representative from the U.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. J.D. Burton with the University of Minnesota. First of all, thank you for your support of the University of Minnesota, Representative Lesh.
The
university is not a student loan servicer. We have a small university trust fund loan, which we provide to students as sort of a bridge loan. We don't service the loans. We provide them exit counseling, which is required by the federal government, but we don't do any servicing. Our concern was that the language here, because we do interact with borrowers, would bring us into the regulations as a loan servicer and under the guidelines that are here, which is something that we don't do. So we had requested to have that exemption. We think it's an unintended consequence of the bill.
Okay. Any other discussion or questions? Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, I understand the university's concerns, but they're going to have a lot of students that are not using that program. They're going to be using the other things. It would not be available to them. When we start doing carve-outs, I found it's a bad thing, so I would oppose this amendment.
Okay. Representative Herr, go ahead.
Thank you, Chair Lash. And maybe just a quick question. Is the University of Minnesota the only university that would this wouldn't apply to? Are there other universities in the state of Minnesota that also are not loan servicers?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
Can I just want to offer a couple points of clarification. Just I hope it's clear to everyone that we're not sort of exempting the students from the protection of this bill with their student loan servicers just because they go to the University of Minnesota. This is narrowly tailored to a specific program that the University of Minnesota offers. My view of the bill is that they aren't covered underneath it. The university was a little concerned about it. I think this is designed to provide some clarity about this specific program. So I would accept the amendment as a friendly amendment, but it does not, I just want to be clear to Chair Johnson's point that students at the University of Minnesota who have private or public loans and interact with loan servicing companies would be protected under this bill, even with this amendment.
Okay. All right. Any other discussion? Representative Herr.
I guess I just want to still make sure that there are no other universities in the state of Minnesota that would fall under the same category as University of Minnesota, that they may not service loans, but it might look like it might apply to them. I would hate to do one exception for our university when other universities might be in the exact same situation.
Representative Stevenson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Herr, I'm not aware of any others that do this. No others have contacted me. We can certainly keep an eye out for that and look into it and make sure that we're in the same place. Again, as I said, my view of the language and consulting with attorneys working on this bill is that it wouldn't apply to this program anyway, but I have no objection to giving the University of Minnesota extra clarity and comfort.
Thank you. Chair Liebling.
Well, Mr. Chair, maybe one of the ways to deal with this would be to rewrite the amendment, and rather than exempting the university by name, would be to just specify the functions that the university is performing as being not bringing it within the bill. And then that would meet, I think, Representative Herr's concern, because I share her concern. I mean, it's great if a court ever looks at this and comes back and listens to the tape and understands that we're intending not to sweep in other institutions similarly. But when you stick just one in here, kind of to the point made by Representative Johnson, it looks like the others, you know, like I could understand somebody thinking, well, because we exempted one and not the others, that the others are included. So I think it would be much better to exempt the university by what functions it's doing to make it clear that those functions do not bring it within the bill.
Chair Liebling, the amendment modifies page 4, line 7 of the bill. Do you have a laundry list of those functions, or like, if we're going to draft on the fly, like, do you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Stevenson.
As I've said a couple times now, we do have a couple more committee stops, so we can talk about this issue and try and see if there's a way. I'm not sure that solution will exactly work, because some of the functions that the university performs are also performed by student loan servicers, and I wouldn't want student loan servicers to say, because we do these functions, we don't follow under the bill. They do other things. That is what we're concerned about. But the example of exit counseling is probably a good one that a lot of people do. I don't think it brings them under the just doing exit counseling doesn't bring you under the scope of the bill. You got to do other things as well. But that's something that both the university does and student loan companies do, if that makes some sense.
Surely.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, exactly. So you could put a line in here that says, if you only do exit counseling, that does not bring you under the bill, right? I mean, I think there's a way to do it, and I certainly don't want to try to craft anything on the fly, and I'm not that familiar with the issue. So, you know, I would leave it to the author, and he's very, very capable of figuring out some kind of elegant solution for
this. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Then, all in favor of the A11 amendment, with the current discussion, you know, notwithstanding, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no.
No.
Motion passes. The A11 is adopted. So the bill has been amended twice. We amended the A10, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. We did the A10. Okay, so both are adopted. All right, any other? Okay, we got more testifiers. So we got Mr. Elwood and Uninger.
Yeah, I think there are
and
three.
And Welk, too. Come on down. Welcome back to the committee, Mr. Elwood.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. I just want to, we're here in support of House File 1424. Just to say that, add to the discussion that, you know, we see too many cases kind of on the back end of clients subject to abusive debt collection practices, who are the debt being the student debt. We also have an elder law project, and the fact that we have more elders now in student debt is something that we're aware of. So I think, you know, in particular, the advocate would be extremely helpful for better outcomes for students and not getting them the problems they're in, and the establishment of rules of the road for servicing practices, student loan servicing practices, is an extremely important part of this bill. So in sum, we're just here to support it and thank Representative Stevenson for bringing it forward.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Can you tell me, how did the banks wiggle their way out of having student loans be able to be not discharged in bankruptcy?
Mr. Chairman, members, actually, I can't tell you that.
Does anyone in the room know that? Because I want to know that. I know it's federal, but... Yeah, I know it's the federal.
So they're not going to let you bankrupt.
Well,
yeah,
Mr.
Still
Chair...
found a way to be sneaky about it. Go ahead, Representative Steve.
I think the suggestion was made that because most loans are originate federally, that the federal government didn't want the discharge. But actually, the no discharge predates when the federal government took over during the Bush administration almost all student loans. It's a longer principle that I could speculate. I don't know the answer. So I'll leave it at that.
Okay. Well, somebody tell me after the fact, because that's particularly...
I'll share my speculation with you.
We do a lot of that in this committee, Representative Stevenson. Is there another testifier who can come now?
There are two, I believe.
Come on now. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Sasha Younginger.
Say your name again.
Sasha?
Yeah.
Younginger.
Younginger, thank
yes.
you. Go ahead.
Sir Chair and members of the committee, my name is Sasha Younginger, and I'm a special education teacher at Roosevelt High School in South Minneapolis. I have taught for the past 10 years, and I currently teach 10th grade. And like so many teachers, I'm wondering if the stress we feel on a daily basis is worth it. In addition to increasing challenges we face in public education, I still owe $123,000 on my student loans. That's right, you heard it, $123,000. My balance was much smaller when I graduated from college 10 years ago. But because of inaccurate information provided by my loan servicer, my education debt continues to grow. When I went into repayment, I was told my monthly payment would be $900 a month. $900 a month on a starting teacher salary. I told them I couldn't afford that and asked for other options. I was told that $900 was my only option. I was told if I paid less, it wouldn't count as a qualifying payment. I offered to pay as much as $300 a month, but they said no. My loan servicer never told me about income-driven repayment options, which would have allowed me to easily fulfill a qualifying payment of $300 a month. Instead, after failing to make the $900 payments, they began to garnish my wages. I was able to get into a rehabilitation plan for these loans, making payments for a required 9-month period. After completing the rehabilitation, my servicer told me they had no record of the payments and my rehabilitation does not count. I have made multiple calls to my loan servicer, and in each case, I call the number given to talk about my rehabilitation, and the person on the other end of the phone call tells me no one can help me and gives me a second number. I call the second number and get a third and then a fourth number and inevitably end up back to the first number. No one is able to or willing to help, and this is unacceptable. Finally, years later, I have now entered repayment and have made my first payment. As I mentioned, if my loan servicer had told me 10 years ago that I could have been on an income-based repayment plan, I would have been able to afford my loan payments from the start. I asked all the questions I could think of to ask. If they told me the truth, my life would be so differently today. I dream of fostering children in need, but until my finances are stable, that's not an option. I now and know I'm not alone, and that other people have nightmare experiences with their loans as well. This bill will put in place so many things that could have helped me. If a loan servicer was required to keep records, if they had to meet the standards for sharing information like borrowers with me, or if they simply had to provide me with information about different repayment options, my life would be different now. So please support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Younginger. Other testifiers?
We have one more, Mr. Chair.
Come on down.
Mr. Chair, members, good morning. My name is Adam Welly. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. thank the chairman and the committee for the opportunity to testify at today's hearing. The Attorney General strongly supports House File 1424 as addressing a serious gap in Minnesota's financial regulatory scheme and helping prevent some of the worst abuses that we have seen in the student loan servicing industry. And I want to thank Representative Stevenson and the other co-authors for sponsoring this bill, which can bring necessary oversight and accountability to an industry that affects more than 750,000 Minnesotans. And while I'm happy to discuss any aspect of the bill today, Representative Stevenson has asked me to focus on the data sharing aspects of this bill for this committee. I work in the Consumer Wage and Antitrust Division at the AG's office, and that division plays a number of roles in protecting and advocating for Minnesota consumers harmed by fraud and other abuse in the marketplace. We investigate violations of consumer protection laws. We bring enforcement actions in court to stop violations. We assist in resolving complaints by Minnesotans, and we conduct other advocacy to help consumers. In fiscal year 2019, our Consumer Services Division, which we assist, returned more than $4 million to the public as part of our mediation efforts, and that's in addition to the millions that our office obtains in restitution and penalties in the enforcement actions that we bring to remediate violations. Under the most recent amendment, House File 1424 builds on this role within the AG's office by creating the student loan advocate. The person will be charged with receiving and mediating complaints with servicers, reviewing complicated loan histories with borrowers, and educating the public on issues and rights related to student loans and making recommendations to the legislature. The office already receives many complaints from consumers about student loan servicers. In the last 5 years, I looked up, we have over 1,000 complaints concerning for Minnesota borrowers for just the federal student loan servicers operating in the state. These complaints involve a variety of issues, improperly steering borrowers into costly forbearance statuses, misapplying payments, failing to respond to borrower inquiries, misrepresenting repayment options, providing inaccurate information about a borrower's progress towards federal loan forgiveness. And absent an active investigation, this consumer complaint data is treated as private under the Government Data Practices Act under Section 13.65. House File 1424 makes clear that consumer complaint data received through the student loan advocate will maintain this private status under Section 13.65. It also, however, allows the Attorney General's Office and the Department of Commerce to communicate in their roles under this bill and also share information as needed with the Office of Higher Education or the U.S. Department of Education and other law enforcement. It's very important that we be able to coordinate with the Department of Commerce, who has examination authority under this bill for these loan servicers. So proper and reasonable oversight of servicers is an important piece in addressing the student debt crisis in our view. And so the AG supports House File 1424 and hopes that the committee and the legislature will pass this legislation and bring accountability to this industry.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Welly, Chair Liebling.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Welly, for your testimony. Boy, and thank you to the teacher who testified. Wow. So my question is, I don't know a lot about this area, but how are these loan servicers paid? Do they have a financial interest in having the borrower owe more? It is just incredible what's being described here, and it just makes me think of the pharmaceutical industry, frankly. You know, are there incentives here that, you know, why in the world would they not mislead this woman about her options unless they have a financial incentive to do so? Can you explain that?
Mr. Welly.
Mr. Chair, Representative, they are not paid by the borrower, and I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. The borrower does not choose who their servicer is. The lender who made the loan chooses who the servicer is and pays the servicer. I don't know the exact details of how the payment arrangements work between lenders and servicers, but I do know that based on the complaints we're seeing, the complaints like we heard here, the issues that we've heard here today, there is concern that the servicers don't have a financial incentive to take the time to make sure that a borrower is on the correct repayment plan, to make sure that the borrower is doing all the right things to potentially obtain loan forgiveness under existing law. So, you know, one of the reasons why I think this bill is required is because those financial incentives are not there. We also have reports from other enforcement actions around the country and investigations that some servicers would, in light of what you're talking about, incentivize those on the phone to get the representatives on the phone to get off the phone as soon as possible. And so what that often would lead to is servicers putting someone on forbearance when anytime they express any financial hardship relating to paying back the loan, when in fact what that person should be on is an income-based repayment that takes account of their discretionary income and would lead to federal loan forgiveness. So when they were incentivized to get off the phone as fast as possible, they would just do the forbearance because that was the quickest, easiest way to get someone off the phone. So one of the reasons this bill is required is, we think, to bring accountability and prevent that kind of perverse incentive.
Thank you.
I was thinking of, Chair Liebling, I was thinking of the pharmaceutical industry, but also, for the first time just a few months ago, I started watching The Sopranos the first time on HBO. It's 20 years old. But when I got the financial aid package offer for my daughter last summer, or almost coming up on a year ago now, I was floored. And then the options they offered for supplementary parental loans and the interest rates that were offered, as well as the disbursement fees, that if you don't know what you're doing, you quickly find yourself in 11% or 12% interest rate payback that, of course, accrues over the course of 4 years at minimum, and it's an absolute and total scam. Higher education financing is a scam, and higher education is complicit, hand in hand, just like all those thugs on The Sopranos are complicit with each other, okay? It's an absolute fact. I still have, I don't know how many, over 30 grand in student loans left. And it doesn't seem like they really go down at all. And I'm paying tuition for my daughter at the same time to a higher education institution that my dad went to for $6 a credit in the late 50s, and which now is the equivalent of $325 a credit, ballpark. That's over 1,000% increase over the rate of inflation in those years. This is a scam. There is no question about it. So I appreciate it. I think this is a small start, Representative Stevenson. It's The Sopranos. Chair Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you have any advice for the young woman? Is there something that the Attorney General's office can do to help her?
Mr. Willie.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we can assist her. We have a Consumer Services Division, and I'd be happy to talk with her after this hearing. And what we often do is we will look at the borrower's, the issues they've raised, we can look at their loan file if they give us permission, and then we will mediate with we send letters and make contact with the servicer and raise issues. And when I mentioned earlier the $4 million that we've obtained in money back to consumers, it's part of those mediation efforts. Sometimes the company will make it right and refund the money or provide some other remedy. Sometimes just explaining, you know, their position and what, you know, what happened and what next is all we can get, but we can do whatever we can, and we have a Consumer Services Division and many people who can assist her.
Thank you.
Chair Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just real quickly, based on his answer, the question and the answer, it seems to me like the Attorney General's office is already helping people in this regard. I'm not sure, you know, if people are already able to be helped through the Attorney General's office, why we're creating a new level of government. But I do want to agree with you, and I was going to just say, you know, let's not put all the blame on the student loan, the companies offering the student loans to students. And I'm glad you said what you said, Mr. Chair, because it is a racket between higher education and this whole student loan thing. And I think it has to go up the food chain to the federal government. And as long as the federal government continues to dole these things out, the universities and stuff are going to continue to raise tuition because they know that the kids are going to get the loans to pay for the tuition. So thank you, Mr. Chair. That's all.
Representative Lucero.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to say, hear, hear to your scam comments. I'm probably going to have to owe you or purchase a Shamrock Shake for you for those comments.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Stephen, I appreciate what you're trying to do here. Parent, I was just wondering if you've, because with this amendment, there's new responsibilities And I'm guessing with the student population of just the University of Minnesota in 2014 was just about 52,000 people. The Attorney General's office can probably have to hire more staff. Have you, with this amendment, have you requested a fiscal note?
Representative Stevenson. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes. There is a fiscal note back on this bill, and we will be discussing it in great detail, I'm sure, in state government finance in the near future.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Lesh, Representative Stevenson, thank you. Because I think, just rough mind, in my mind, you're looking at probably 10 to 15 employees are going to be needed for this program with the total number of college students that we have out there. Unfortunately, the Department of Education created part of this nightmare. Back in the late 70s, early 80s, they made a decision that the goal of Minnesota was 70% of the high school kids going to college. Not technical schools, two-year and four-year colleges. Unfortunately, even today, the job market only requires about 20% of the jobs to have a college education. And my high school superintendent explained it the best. You have 20% of the kids are going to do absolutely nothing after high school. You have 20% of the kids that a 2 and 4 year degree is not a problem. But we have now have created 60% of the kids in the middle banging their heads against the walls thinking that they're a failure because we're pushing them into a program that they probably can't make. It's going to be very difficult. And now we have all sorts of extra costs and student loans to pay for remedial classes to get into the college course they decided to go in, where technical colleges and skilled labor jobs is perfect for them. I think to deal with some of this stuff, not only do we need to work on the student debt and to help those that are being abused by some of the services, we need to take a really good look at the push to push all these kids into college courses and college debt when we don't even have the jobs for them.
Thank you. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Chair Lesh, and thank you, Representative Stevenson, for bringing this bill. I am in complete support of it. I do just want to say, though, that not that I don't agree with Chair Lesh, I do agree with you, but I don't want to beat up our higher ed institutions and our, especially our public ones, because I came from the financial sector, and the things that exist isn't driven by our public higher ed institutions. It's really by private sector individuals who make a lot of money out of these loans, whose loans then are turned into backed securities and bonds and the derivative markets. And there's this huge market that's built up just based on the loans themselves. And so there's this huge scheme of people and all of these individuals involved, and the universities just happens to be where they're going. And I'm not saying the private universities I'm not categorizing them all in the same. I'm just saying for our public institutions that they are very needed and necessary. And I'll just give a quick example of, so when I was in college at Madison, there was a professor, Werner DeBont, who was my finance professor. He was an amazing professor, but we lost him to other institutions, to private institutions, and now he's like world renowned for his behavioral finance in the field of behavioral finance. Public institutions can't keep up with other institutions if they're not going to pay professors rates in which then they will lose some of the best minds to other institutions, and they're trying to compete with public dollars with private institutions. So I just wanted to kind of throw that caveat out there that I don't want our public institutions, our public universities to sort of take the blame for what has happened within the financial sector and the people making all the money off of this and those situations that happen. So I just wanted to throw that little bit out there. I'm not saying that they're free of that, higher ed institutions, public or private, are free of blame, but I just wanted to maybe throw an understanding of the complexities of how these financial systems come into play. So,
thank you for that comment, Representative Herr. And yeah, I went to a private undergrad, and every year that I was there, the president, Lawrence Biondi, Jesuit, always wore his collar, so you had to respect him because he was a man of God, right? And he increased our tuition double digit every single year on the premise that they had to be competitive with other colleges. This, of course, didn't mean competitive for their students, but competitive with other regional institutions, public and private, who were seeking to drain students of their future money. I want to welcome the ninth grade of Lakes International Language Academy from Forest Lake, Minnesota. You're here at a perfect time because we're talking about how you're all going to be hosed in about 4 years. With tuition prices and student loans. And between, Yeah, you're going to have an advocate from the Attorney General's office when that's after you get hosed. But between now and then, make sure you learn a little bit about finance, because it's going to make a big difference when you're getting in. You're saying, oh, yeah, I'll just take out loans for that, you know. And then after you get out of school, you're like, well, I guess I'm, you know, not living in an apartment. I'm living in my parents' basement and riding a scooter for the next 7 years. Yeah, that's right. We have a scooter. So thank you very much for being here. Welcome. And is there any other conversation or committee discussion? Chair Liebling?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is such a compelling bill. And it, this is the issue of our age, honestly, or one of the big ones. And thank you again to the testifier who talked about her own situation. It's not easy to do that, but boy, what a, no one should be in that situation. My own sister, my older sister, is still paying off her loans, if you can believe that. She doesn't live in Minnesota, but this has to end. And I think this bill is a really great step. This is such a compelling issue. I would like to have a roll call, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to follow up and with what Representative Johnson was saying, then Representative Herr. As a former college instructor myself at a public college, State University here in Minnesota for 5 years, I do lay a lot of blame at all colleges, including the public ones. And one of the things that makes me incredibly frustrated is that these colleges and universities offer degree programs that are completely worthless. Some degrees, completely worthless, with no marketable skill set that an employer is going to be willing to pay for, and therefore makes it incredibly difficult for a person, a student, who has spent tens of thousands of dollars going into debt to obtain this degree that they will not then be able to pay back. So it's very frustrating, but this is an important issue. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And first of all, thank you, Representative Stevenson. I think this is a long overdue response. And actually, we probably shouldn't have waited for a response. We should have had a more foresight many years ago, particularly once we saw the escalating prices of tuition. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But I do want to just very quickly say that there's part, in my mind, there are different components here. And I came in late, so that you might have already spoke about this, but part of who's responsible also is us in the state legislature. You know, we put out a lot of resources in the form of institutional aid that arguably has not kept pace with the true cost factors of delivering higher education. Similarly, we've not arguably kept pace with student financial aid to meet that as well. And so I would hope that part of what happens if this is successful is that there is a there is another body we can turn to, an expert, relative to how all those pieces are interconnected. And a long time ago, Mr. Chair, the state made a commitment that to the people of Minnesota that we would have a shared responsibility for post-secondary. And I and many others would argue that we the legislative body, has largely reneged on that commitment. And so the pressures have built more on the part of the citizens. And so anyway, I just want to get that out. And then, Mr. Chair, you know that I direct the education equity nonprofit, and I would invite members in the public to visit our website. We just issued a policy paper touching on this issue, although focusing on student financial aid, and basically making the argument that we need a different formula in the state to reflect the changed economic realities of Minnesotans, and in particular, the way that plays out in different communities, communities of color, indigenous communities, in particular, low-income communities generally. So it's the Minnesota Education Equity Partnership, and I would invite folks to visit our website for that for that recently published paper. But thank you, Representative Stevenson, for your bill.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Been in too many committees today. I come from a somewhat interesting background in the financial services industry, and counseling to families as well as their children. And as part of my continuing education, I provided voluntarily service to high schools, both juniors and seniors, actually offering them classroom instruction on financial planning and financial literacy. And one of the tells that this bill actually brings forward, Representative Stevenson, is the sad truth that our youth are not prepared from a financial literacy perspective in any way, shape, or form, preparing them for adulting decisions that occur after they graduate from high school. And I say that from personal experience. I have three of my own children, and the first thing that we went through, as you, Chair Lesh, went through with his the financial aid package that took literally more time than I want to recognize filling out online and then trying to make sure that it actually hit either the federal or the state entities. But notwithstanding that, going through the maze and understanding, even for a practitioner of financial services for over 25 years, the disclaimers on the notes, whether they be private or public loans, in terms of, I wouldn't say they're deceptive practices, because you are engaging in a willing buyer and a willing seller, engaging in a contractual arrangement, which this body and this committee speaks to. But it is sad and somewhat tragic that we have come to a point where the velocity of the cost for any education has outstripped the pace of wages, but also outpaced and the means by which our youth and our young adults contemplate what they enter into in a contractual arrangement. Because you're 18 and a consenting adult does not necessarily suggest that you understand contract law. And I'm speaking to the ninth graders up there. You turn 18, you are financially obligated to your signature. Remember that. No one can, under duress, force you to sign on to a piece of a contract that obligates you to a monthly payment. So prepare yourself. Do not rely upon others. And what this bill is doing is responding to the lack of financial literacy that we have not provided to our young adults. Notwithstanding the pace of costs for education and the choices that individuals make for their career paths, we all have a responsibility. You have a responsibility to your person for the decisions you make, but the institutions that you enter into for your collegiate and career path also have a responsibility to be forthcoming, to be transparent, and to be diligent about understanding what you're obligating your students to undertake in terms of a financial plan that may never get paid back. Don't push the obligation for payback onto remediators and consolidators and bills like this. To Chair Lesh and to others that have expressed it, I think this is a symptom of a greater cancer that has been created by the higher educational learning experience that in some circles has obligated us to think about a four-year education as the only way that you're going to have a proper and successful life. That is a false narrative. Get over it. Representative Stevenson, I appreciate your bill. I applaud your efforts. I don't necessarily agree with all of them, but I do recognize that we do need to facilitate support of those that are suffering from predatory practices. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Representative Albright. Representative Stevenson, last word for the roll call.
Yes, very briefly, I just want to say that I think Representative Albright is correct. That bill does include instruction to the student loan advocate to create an educational course to get exactly at the issues he's talking about, making sure people understand. And for the people in the audience, what I would want them to know is that they need to look up what compound interest is and understand that compound interest can either work for you or you can work for compound interest. That's the choice that you have to make in life. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Stevenson. Roll call has been requested. House, the House File 1424 as amended is the motion that it be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Chair votes aye.
Representative Mueller. Yes. Representative Scott. Representative Albright.
Aye.
Representative Barr.
No.
Representative Cantrell.
Yes.
Representative Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Considine.
Yes.
Representative Hassan. Representative Herr.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Lucero.
Yes.
Representative Liebling.
Yes.
Representative Mariani.
Yes.
Representative Knorr.
Yes.
Representative O'Neill.
Yes.
Representative Robbins. Representative Zhang.
There being 14 votes in favor and one vote against, the motion passes. House File 1424, as amended, is recommended to be re-referred to the State Government Finance Committee. Thank you, Representative Stevenson. I'll now pass the gavel over to Chair Mueller. I've got two bills, 3517 and 3659.
All right, Mr. Chair, would you like to move your bill, House File 3517?
Yes, I would move that, Madam Chair. Where am I moving it?
I believe you're moving it to the General Register.
Then that is my motion, Madam Chair.
All right, then please go ahead and tell us about your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This expands the scope of the location tracking warrant related to a certain problem with social media that I can have our wonderful Bemidji police officer here testify to. Thank you.
All right. Welcome, Chief. Please introduce yourself for the committee, and then you can begin.
I'm Mike Mastin. I'm the Chief of Police with the City of Bemidji. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity this morning. I really appreciate it. I'm not certain if you've received my letter, which was drafted to the Chiefs Association, excuse me, the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, that addresses this concern. I didn't see it in the materials up top, so I will just read it if that's what you prefer to. I think it really explains what we're looking at in this issue. Technology continues to advance faster than our laws and legislation can evolve. I think we can all agree to that. For years, the Bemidji Police Department has utilized tracking warrant statute, which is 626A.42, to locate suspects of violent crimes, suicidal individuals, juvenile runaways, and other missing persons. In the spring of 2018, a Bemidji police officer took a report of a juvenile female threatening to kill herself using the social media platform Snapchat. An exigency request was made to Snapchat for the location of that user. Snapchat immediately provided the location for the juvenile female, who was found unharmed. This taught our detectives that social media platforms could provide location of users in times of immediate need or through the use of a search warrant. More than a year later, in August of 2019, our detectives were attempting to locate the suspect of a drug-related homicide. After exhausting all of our investigative resources, Bemidji police detectives requested a tracking warrant for the suspect's Snapchat account. On August 28th and 19th, Snapchat Incorporated responded to the tracking warrant, indicated they would not produce location information. Essentially, Snapchat's argument is the account is not a specific electronic device. Rather, it's a product, which is a unique identifier that can be utilized on multiple electronic devices. And I'll read you a portion of their response as follows. Minnesota law requires that such requests be targeted at electronic devices. Location information means information concerning the location of an electronic device that in whole or in part is generated or derived from or obtained by the operation of an electronic device. Accordingly, Snapchat objects to the tracking warrant as Snapchat account is not an electronic device under Minnesota law. This interpretation came as a surprise, and that interpretation is concerning as it will substantially reduce or eliminate investigative resources which have been used in all types of investigations. Shortly after Snapchat's denial, Bemidji police detectives were working on a report of an endangered indigenous female juvenile runaway. This juvenile had a cell phone but no cellular service. However, utilizing free Wi-Fi, she was able to use Snapchat and Facebook Messenger for communication. Detectives knew that Snapchat would not honor a tracking warrant, so a tracking warrant was submitted to Facebook in an attempt to locate this female. With the cooperation of Facebook, the juvenile female was located safely. In January, just 2 months ago, a family reported a missing adult indigenous female. They suspected that she was the victim of sex trafficking and was being transported across northern Minnesota into Michigan. The victim was sporadically using Snapchat to communicate with her family. Due to the denial of the tracking warrant from the previous case in the fall of 2019, detectives were unable to pursue a tracking warrant for the Snapchat account. This female remained missing for nearly a week before she reappeared. My concern before the misinterpretation of the statutory language leads to a tragedy, it's my recommendation that unique identifier be added to the statute.
Thank you, Chief. Are there any other testifiers on this bill? All right, then we can open it up for member questions. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Chair Lesh. I guess it would be to counsel here. Is there currently a definition of electronic communication application or service in statute,
Mr. Johnson?
Or is this a new term?
Madam Chair, members, that term is not defined within this particular section of law. If it appears other places in the statute without a cross-reference, that definition does not automatically apply here.
Okay. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Lesh, I appreciate this bill. I think it's very important. I'm just going to throw out some my initial thoughts here. Rather than narrowing it to an electronic communication, because there's technology out there that's designed to communicate, right? And I'm guessing Snapchat or these other social media platforms are categorized as communication platforms. But just trying to think into the future and a little bit more broadly, I'm wondering if language similar to any hardware or software associated with a technology system. So a technology system rather than a communication system, because I think of a communication system as a subset of a technology system.
Representative Chair, the word or the definition unique identifier probably can be best explained. Most of us are familiar with a checkbook from our bank. So your checkbook is very similar to your application, whether it's Snapchat, Facebook, TikTok, whatever. The unique identifier is that checking account number. It's your unique identifying, whether it's alphanumeric, whether it's one software product or another software product, it applies across the industry as a unique identifier. That's why we chose that particular.
Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, and I understand unique identifier. Okay. It is a username would be another example, logging into a computer. An email address would be an example of an alphanumeric unique identifier, because there can only be one username within Gmail, for example. But what I'm saying is a unique identifier within a technology system, rather than a unique identifier within a communications system. So I'm suggesting just be a little bit more broad, trying to take into account the future innovation of technology.
And Madam Chair and Representative Lucero, I know where you're going with that. And yes, to the extent that you want to offer some language like that, I'd be completely open to it. Members who've served on this committee for years know that we put language out here, and then 5 years it becomes obsolete based upon some other different medium of how we're either communicating or transacting information. And so we do our best to try to get ahead of it. There's no way that probably 20 years ago anyone would even have come close to anticipating that we were going to be having to deal with problems like this. You know, 20 years from now, it'll be the same thing. So to the extent that's helpful, yeah, I'd be open to an amendment like that.
Any other discussion from members? Seeing none. Sorry. Chair Liebling.
Sorry. Thanks, Madam Chair. And just to, you know, maybe that would be satisfied. I don't know if Representative Lucero, if we just took out the word communication on line 2.5, so that it would be within a given electronic application or service. Because I hear your concern. You're just thinking it's too limited, just a little too limited. It's just a suggestion. I have no expertise in this area, but it just occurred to me it might be pretty easy to fix.
Madam Chair.
Oh, go ahead.
I appreciate the suggestion. Rather than do it on the fly, what I'd like to do is just take a little bit more time and see if there's an existing definition we might be able to cross-reference or something like that. And definitely, I'll work with Chair Lesh. Thank you.
Sounds good. Thank you. Any other comments? Any other members? All right. Seeing none, Chair Lesh moves that House File 3517 be recommended to be placed on the general register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3517 is recommended to be placed on the general register. Chair Lesh, we have another bill from you, House File 3659.
Yes.
And I believe you want to move that to be placed on the general register.
That is my motion, Madam Chair.
Okay. And I also see that we have an amendment here, the A2 amendment. Would you like to speak to your amendment, Chair Lesh?
Actually, if I could have the smarter people than me speak to my amendment, Madam Chair, that'd be great.
Okay, great. First, we need to move the A2 amendment, right?
I so move, Madam Chair.
Okay, thank you. And then if your testifier can introduce themselves and explain the amendment to us, please.
Chair, members, if it's okay, I just briefly want to walk through the Safe at Home program. Just that gives a little bit of context for the
that would be excellent. Thank you. Go right ahead.
Yes. My name is Sam Bonowitz. I'm the Director of Government Relations with the Office of the Secretary of State. The Safe at Home program is our state's address confidentiality program for those who fear for their safety or who have high risk or high safety needs. Think survivors of domestic abuse, stalking, law enforcement officials, judges. When Minnesota's program began in 2007, there were about a dozen other states with a program like Safe at Home, and now there are approximately 40 states around the country with an address confidentiality program. What this does when people enroll with Safe at Home, our office assigns them a St. Paul P.O. Box address that all public and private entities must accept and use as that person's real address. So their driver's license has the P.O. Box in St. Paul on it, and only the Safe at Home office knows the participant's true address. Most Safe at Home participants, like I said, are crime or abuse victims, and the use of Safe at Home address allows them to go about their daily life without having their address accessible to the person that they fear. There are very, very rare occasions when another government office may need to know a participant's address, true address, such as when the participant purchases a home, or if there is a requested social service that must be delivered to the participant's home. And there are obviously instances when a utility company needs to know the service address. And our office has worked extensively and established special safety protocols for these rare instances. But for the most part, the only address a Safe at Home participant provides others is an assigned P.O. Box address. That's the only way that the program is truly effective, by people using their Safe at Home address. This is a safety tool, and it's an effective strategy for people who need physical safety and emotional security. Since the program's inception, almost 11,000 people have been served. The Safe at Home office assists participants by forwarding mail on a daily basis, helping with them interactions with third parties for those who need to understand legal compliance, problems with third party stakeholders, and helping participants understand how to use their Safe at Home address. The changes in this bill and primarily the amendments, I'll speak to the amendment now. Section one, this is really just clarifying for us what the definition of mail is for Safe at Home purposes. The program is growing, so we just want to be clear. Right now, we do forward federal packages, think packages from the Social Security Administration. We forward those to participants. We just want to make sure that's in statute to clarify for both participants and staff at Safe at Home. And then we also just wanted to clarify that we don't have the capacity to forward refrigerated pharmaceuticals. This hasn't been an issue in our office at all. I think we had one instance years ago where somebody tried to do that, and we ended up just having them come to one of our Secretary of State offices and pick it up. So that hasn't been an issue, again, because the program is growing. We just want to make sure that that's clear in statute for both participants and for staff at the Safe at Home office. Section 2 just clarifies the original intent of this law, which was that the notice to private entities can be sent to entities. You know, we send these, the participants send these notices to private entities to companies. We haven't had an issue with this company, but just as an example, CenterPoint Energy, and making it clear that statute allows for that to happen. Section 3, so 5B.10 was passed in 2009, and it was because of concerns about some municipal ordinances that required the posting of tenants and their apartment numbers inside the entrance of an apartment building. And so this statute prohibited Safe at Home participants' names from being posted. But since 2009, we've heard from participants that landlords sometimes post notices for the participant on their apartment door that has their name on it. Think something as simple as, like, Sam Bonowitz, you need to move your car. And so we just want to make sure that landlords aren't posting that information of where that participant lives publicly. The rest of this bill, I will let Hennepin County speak to. It does two primary things. Allows for flexibility for participants to decide what information is private they would like to have private, and allows the flexibility of counties to share Safe at Home participant information with other government entities for the purposes of tax and assessment purposes. But.
Okay, thanks. And before we move on with more in the bill, we do need to pass this amendment. So I think you gave a really good overview of the bill and then specifics of the amendment. Do members have any discussion about the amendment? All right, seeing none. All those in favor of the 8-2 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And now we can move on to the bill as amended. And I believe you have another testifier, Chair Lesh, who would like to speak to that.
Yes.
Yeah. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and you can begin.
Thank you. My name is Amber Bouget and I'm the Chief Deputy Recorder for Hennepin County. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota County Recorders Association Legislative Committee. And Hennepin County and the Secretary of State have collaborated on this language, and we all agree that this is the best approach. I'm going to briefly just touch upon a few of the main changes that relate to real property notices, because that's my expertise. A real property notice applies to real property data and protects a Safe at Home participant's identity in connection with a specific property. The changes that we're recommending to the real property notice requirements recognize that there are other entities that have real property data that may need to be covered by a real property notice other than the county recorder's office. These types of data are normally public data, and we can't go retroactively. So if someone, once someone has owned a home for a long time, there's no way for us to unprivatize all of that data. So the real property notice went into effect to allow county recorders to be able to manage that in a way that only goes prospectively. These changes would allow the assessment records as well as property tax records to be covered by that real property notice.
It also allows for a participant to provide a real property notice to other government entities that might have real property data or records. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Are there any other testifiers to this bill? All right, no questions manager. From members? None? Chair Lesh, any further words of wisdom for us?
No, Madam Chair.
All right, then Chair Lesh moves that House File 3659 as amended be recommended to be placed on the General Register. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and House File 3659 as amended is recommended to be placed on the General Register. Members, please note that we may have an evening hearing on Tuesday the 10th. Okay. And we have several bills. And we don't need to go through all those right now. There are several on here. Do you have a question?
Yes, Madam Chair, and this may be for you or Chair Lesh, but I'm wondering if we're going to be having any kind of an informational hearing on what happened on presidential primary day at the Secretary of State's office with some people being directed to a political website to find their polling place, and the fact that their data was probably captured by that other entity that they were directed to, and if there's going to be any follow-up. And I think this is something that our committee could certainly take a look at to see what happened with any data that was collected or shared after that incident. I'm just wondering if
Chair Lesh.
We might be able to take a look at that.
Madam Chair and Chair Scott, Secretary of State's office is overseen by state government finance. To the extent there's any data questions about that, if there is any kind of hearing in that committee, I mean, we would consider that, but I hadn't heard about any data leakage on that. So I'm open to listen to any information about that, but you presenting this here is the first I've heard about any concerns about any data leakage.
Chair John.
Chair Mueller, Chair Scott, what I heard, there was over 400 people whose data was captured by that fiasco. So I think it's something that we should look at.
Okay.
Chair Lesh.
Well, I this is the first time hearing about any of that. So maybe I could ask, captured, Chair Johnson, by who?
Chair Lesh, it was the website. In order to get on to find your polling place, you had to, it was capturing your Facebook information, your emails, and your phone information in order to get to the login to find your polling place.
Oh, okay. So, Madam Chair, I think I understand. So you were concerned that we're not talking about government data. Some other outside entity or something like that. Okay, well, and that's not really, well, I guess if someone presents something to me to take a look at it, I can see it, but I guess my first expectation is that if there are any concerns about that, the proper oversight committee is state government finance, and if there's any revelations about data leakage that people want to bring up, I can listen to that.
All right, with that, the meeting is adjourned.